and this was we spent time there, and at that point the Germans were in terrible shape. You and cigarettes were the medium of exchange. It's interesting that, you know, cigarettes have gotten in such bad favor. At that point they were like gold. And I didn't smoke. So, and we got rations of cigarettes, like, you know, just like the soldiers, the officers did. And when you visited some German chemist or plant manager or someone like that, generally you would take a package of cigarettes and just sort of casually leave. You know, he couldn't give you, it offended him to give them to him, but everybody understood, and so you would just sort of casually leave your cigarettes. We were also forbidden to eat in on the German economy. We couldn't eat in the, we were forbidden to eat at the, you know, they had, in Germany, they had what they called casinos at that point, that were what we'd call employee clubs, or sort of a combination eating facility, recreation facility, that would have included in the executive dining rooms. And I have sat in a executive dining room in either Ludwigshafen or Herxt, and with a waiter waiting on me, and eat a sandwich that they prepared at the last officer's club, with a waiter helping me unwrap it. we couldn't eat in their places.
How receptive were the Germans to your visiting them?
90% of them were very receptive. The only one that I remember was, it was not at all receptive, was Dr. Soxey, who was the inventor of this methane to acetylene process. He was very difficult, and we were also in the French occupation zone. And somewhat to my surprise, the French behaved almost as though they were still afraid of the Germans. Mm. In the American and British occupation zones, if there's any trouble at all, they would call the guy in and read the riot act to him. But the French were very reluctant to do that sort of thing. But about, and we must have spent a month with Dr. Soxey, spread maybe over 2 or 3 months. Mm-hmm. And about every week or so, we would have to persuade the French to give Dr. Soxey hell, to get him to cooperate, because he wouldn't do anything that he didn't have to do. Other than that, most of them were very nice, very easy to get along with. And interestingly enough, a number of these IG research people had worked in Baton Rouge. Mm. Exxon, or whoever they were then, had a joint project with IG on petrochemicals. And a lot of the original work on making acetylene out of methane started in Baton Rouge, and started in this joint IG Exxon thing. There were at least 3 or 4 of the people that I hadn't known there, but at least we had that kind of tie.
You mentioned Carter from DuPont. Were there any others in your group?
Well, they came. There were no others in my group, but there were lots of others there at the time. I'm trying to think. There was a Carl Kammermeyer who was, I don't know what he was doing. He worked for some company then, but he then became head of chemical engineering at either Iowa State or the University of Iowa. You may have run across him.
I don't recognize the name, but I can check that out. How were you selected to participate in this?
I'm not sure. I think it was because Freeport wanted somebody to go. Mm-hmm. And there were people, I'm just trying to think. I remember Air Products had a number, had a big group over there, because I think the Germans must have done some interesting things on air separation. There was an engineering company that Kellogg, it wasn't, I've forgotten the details of this, but what is now M.W. Kellogg had some branch they set up for, I think, to work on the Manhattan Project.
That was Kellex.
Kellex, that's right. There were a number of Kellex people over there. Air Products, Kellex. I've forgotten who Camomile was working for. But everybody was on a different different routine. We lived in what had been a German spa at Bad Homburg, which is outside of Frankfurt, and operated out of this OIG headquarters in the suburbs of Frankfurt. And we had we were pretty much free to do whatever we wanted to. And I had one interesting, well, I had a lot of interesting experiences, but one, toward the end of my stay, I was in Berlin. A lot of the records, of IG records, had been sort of gathered up, and some had been carried to a place called Griesheim outside of Frankfurt. And I went through those once looking for something, I've forgotten what, and in the course of it ran across correspondence between American company officials and whose names I recognized but didn't know, who had very, in the spirit of the time, signed letters, Heil Hitler, mm-hmm. which they would have been crucified mm-hmm. had those things ever turned up. But these were people that were prominent at the time in the chemical and oil business. But anyway, I went to Berlin, and while I was there, somebody in the military government came and said, "We have a job we'd like you to do. It'll only take a week or so." And I got permission from Freeport to do it. And the job was to join a team, a quadripartite team, an American, British, French, I guess that was it, Russian, who were to implement the provisions of the Potsdam Agreement. Mm. Part of the Potsdam Agreement was that Germany, after the war, would be reduced to the industrial capacity they had in 1938. I don't think many people know this, so they were setting up teams to go around and determine what the capacity of different German production units were, to decide which would be destroyed and which would be left in order to meet the 1938 requirements. And this particular team that was being set up then was to look at sulfuric acid and fertilizer. Well, because of the sulfur business, I had a fair acquaintance with both of them, and I was to be the American representative on this team. Well, the first thing I did was ask, well, now, what is our policy? What do we want? Because a plant that has been damaged, its capacity can be almost anything you want it to be. Mm-hmm. And if you go one way, you could strip Germany of any ability to produce anything, or you could do it so they could produce twice what they did in 78. Now, where do we stand? And to my amazement, nobody had thought about it. Nobody, you know, been no thought of it at all. And one of the good things that happened was that the whole Potsdam Agreement just disappeared at some point. But anyway, we had the first meeting of the team. There was a Russian showed up, a British or an American, and we each brought a translator with us, and we was, you know, assigned. And I think they had given me a French English translator, and the Russian English translator was a British woman who spoke only British English, and so there was a great problem of her understanding what my southern accent. Man, there was a bigger problem there. But we convened, we talked, we planned, and we broke up saying, well, we'll meet in the morning and start on our trip. To what the first factory, whatever it was. The next morning, or rather maybe that evening, they said, I got a phone call saying, well, instead of leaving on the trip, we'll convene again in the headquarters. We convened, and just before the first meeting broke up, I had been requested to ask the Russians to have their people be in uniform, because on previous trips like this, the Germans had not treated the Russian people in civilian clothes respectfully, and they had been unhappy about it. And so I made what seemed like a simple request that the Russians be in uniform, and at that, everybody that showed up in that first meeting was in uniform. Well, we convened again, and a new set of Russians showed up, in sense that we would not let, we objected to a Russian coming in civilian clothes. And so we spent about 2 or 3 hours trying to explain, well, we really didn't care all that much about it. We just thought it would be more comfortable if they weren't in uniform. And so we broke up again with the same plan to leave the next morning, and the same thing happened. We reconvened, and a third set of Russians showed up. I never saw the same Russians twice in a row. And by the fourth day, it was obvious that I'd made some commitments. I'd set aside time to do this. By the fourth day, it was obvious I wasn't going to make my commitments. It was also fairly obvious that this thing wasn't going to get anywhere anyway. And so I pulled out of it, and I learned later that they got a guy who ran a canning plant in somewhere to be the fertilizer expert, and they undoubtedly wrote a report that nobody ever looked at, because everybody forgot about the Potsdam Agreement as soon as things started getting hostile with the Russians. Anyway, that was my one session with quadripartite.
Interesting. You still had, again, I have a couple patents that came out, although I have some questions about the dates, but so you came back from Germany in late 46,
yes.
And you were with Freeport for several more years.
Yeah,
after
I was there
that.
47 and 48.
And you said they weren't buying your recommendations in the petrochemical.
No, well, I spent a lot of time putting together a lot of very interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you think that had any influence on what came much later in your life?
Well, it must have, because you see, at that point, I knew nothing of, you know. I did this right from ground zero. I knew nothing about the petrochemical business. Everything I'd done had been in minerals and sulfur and things like that, but I got very interested in it, and at least had a good academic understanding of it.
Well, you had I found two more patents, as I said. One, again, with you and Chatelain, was dated 1952. And you were no longer with Freeport in 1952.
But this was done.
Done well before that.
Yes, and because it was just slow getting through the memo.
Well, that was probably part of the wartime backlog, too, on
probably.
But it had to do with sodium cyanide, which...
Well, this was part... We ran... I've forgotten why, but we ran a HCN pilot plant.
Really?
And making HCN much like you make nitric acid, with methane, ammonia, and air, and ran this for quite a long time. Well, we really developed a perfectly good sodium HCN process. And that was before, as far as I know, I think other people had done it, but the technology wasn't readily available. And my recollection is that this was really almost anticipation of something that happened more recently, and that is the use of sodium cyanide in gold leaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what motivated it.
Okay.
That there was, at least at that point, appeared to be a shortage of sodium cyanide for gold leaching, and Freeport was still fiddling around in different mineral activities and whatnot.
And then there was another one on saline water treatment to decrease scale forming properties.
Well, this was too an interesting one. And this, you know, you reuse this bleed water. There was no pressure to reuse the water. You were looking for the heat. And it's, I mean, if you exchange heat in a normal tube thing, it scaled up badly. And so I had the idea of, in effect, using a heat pump taking the steam off of the hot bleed water, compressing it and up to a higher temperature, and injecting it in the formation water. And this was what that patent was.
Did Freeport reward you in terms of patents you acquired for them?
I don't think so. No, I don't think that was the. Any part of the custom.
Mm-hmm. Well, you left Freeport, according to my notes, in 1949.
Yes.
Why did you leave?
Well, the story's interesting. I was sitting talking to the chairman of Freeport, telling him I was getting very fed up with writing reports that nobody did anything about, when he got a phone call, and he took it, and the phone call was from a man named Jock Whitney, who was the chairman of the board of Freeport at that point. He was a very well-to-do man who was really almost the father of the venture capital business in this country. J.H. Whitney and Company was one of the early venture capitalists, and he was chairman of Freeport, and he told the president of Freeport, whose name was Langland Williams, that he had made a venture capital investment in a company that was in trouble, and he needed some engineer, technologist to look at it and help get it straightened out. And sight unseen, sitting there without knowing what it was, I took the job. because I was getting fed up with what I was doing. My relations with Freeport people were good, and so I agreed, and the job turned out to be in California, in Pasadena, and they had an inventor had come in and sold them on the idea of making wallboard, this composition board, this wallboard, out of waste newsprint and a mineral called perlite, which is a very lightweight aggregate material. And they were going to pulp the newsprint. The perlite is a volcanic glass that has some water. I'm not sure whether it's trapped mechanically or chemically. And if you heat it at the right rate, you can soften it and expand the water at the same time and blow it up into a sort of puffed rice, something like puffed rice, mm-hmm. and you make a lightweight aggregate, which is now getting fairly common, particularly in plaster. Anyway, this inventor had a furnace for making, expanding perlite, and a process under which he was going to pulp waste newspapers and make it into a wallboard. And at that time, and as far as I know still, most of the moderate price construction in Southern California is they build a frame, then they put composition board on the frame, put chicken wire over that, and then put stucco over it. And that's the way most of the houses are built. So there's a big market for building board like this. And at that point, it was selling at a very high price. Well, everything was fine. There were two things wrong. There were three things wrong with it. The biggest thing wrong with it was that this high price was a result of the wartime shortage. And even though it was 49, they still hadn't built enough capacity to take care of the shortage. Well, about the time that I arrived on the scene, the shortage was over and the price of board went down, so that the economics of the thing got poorer. The other thing is that there were all sorts of technological problems. The furnace he had wore out after two or three days of operation. Most interesting thing was that this wallboard needed a long dryer to dry it, and they had ordered a dryer for it. They designed a plant, ordered a dryer, and built and bought a site for it. But the longest dimension on the site was shorter than the length of the dryer. So I spent most of my time canceling orders, negotiating cancellation settlements, because it was a dead duck. Then we tried to make something of it, and there were two things you can make of it. I decided, and I'm not sure how this came about, that at that point there was a need for fireproof doors of the kind that you have in hotels, and but you wanted fireproof doors with wood paneling, and what you wanted was a fireproof core material. And I got the idea that if you substitute asbestos for the newsprint, we might make a fireproof door. So I spent about 6 or 8 months working on developing a board for this, and was successful in doing one, and we turned it over to the U.S. Plywood, and who have since disappeared from the scene. I've forgotten who bought them, but they made and sold this in the form of doors. I then took the idea of the aggregate part of it, and with Whitney's permission, tried to go in business making aggregate. And did, but it was also obvious that I was never going to make much money at it, because this is inherently a small business. You don't ship a 5 pound per cubic foot material a long way, and so it was obvious this was going to develop in a lot of small plants. And we built one small plant, and I just said, you know, this makes no sense to spend any more time on it. And so I had to start over at the age of 42 or so.
This is, yes, because there's a period of 50 to 51 where your listing says consultant.
That was when I was trying to make this perlite business go.
How did you... What brought you to the point of saying, I'd like to have my own business?
Well, I don't know. You know, this first experience, if I'd never gone through this standard perlite, I probably would have never have done it. But once I did that, I decided at that point I was going to try again before I hung up completely. And if I hadn't done that, I never would have done it. But, you know, the fact that I failed at that just sort of left me with the need to succeed at it.
Mm-hmm. Because your career to this point had been quite varied, but still pretty much engineering oriented.
Yes.
Although when you did get to the Perlite Company, it sounds like you did have some management responsibilities, right, as well as technical.
Yes, so I had really the people, the promoters of the thing, after a few months disappeared from the scene, and it was my job from there on. But anyway, that's when I decided I wanted to do something on my own at some point.
So you were really then moving to, I don't want to say get out of, but at least move away from a totally technical,
yeah,
application.
Oh, yeah. Well, this started when I went in the Army.
Okay.
In the Army, because at that point I decided if I was going to be in this thing, I should be in the big show and not the sideline. And that's when I decided not to take any engineering jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when I got out of the Army, I'd been away from engineering for 4 years. And I was not disposed to go back and go to graduate school or study hard to get caught back up again.
So how did you, when this company failed in California, that was 1951, I guess, how did you go about looking for your next venture?
Well, I came back to New York, and I had to find a job, and my relations with Freeport were still good, and they let me be a consultant for them. They just made a place for me. I decided I didn't want to go back because I was just as sure as I could be it would be exactly the same thing. And so they sort of made a place for me and paid me while I looked for another job. And a couple of things happened in the course of this, and one of them I hadn't thought about until now. Somebody offered me a job, and it's a company that's since disappeared, the old Wyandotte Chemical.
Oh, yes. Yes.
But they insisted I go through 3 days of psychological testing, which was a fascinating 3 days, and it was the most thorough thing I ever went through. The people came back with a very interesting report. First, they said I should be a salesman. And I never thought of selling anything in my life. In fact, I was fairly convinced I couldn't sell anything. The other thing is, they said I didn't want the job, which by that time I didn't realize it, but I already decided myself that I didn't want the job, which left me with a great deal of respect for the psychological testing people. Anyway. I took a job at Freeport to do exactly what I'd been doing I took a job at FMC, doing just what I'd been doing at Freeport, but I was more convinced that they would do something about it. And I really started out pretty much almost at an entry level sort of analyst kind of thing. And had probably worked about a year on the miscellaneous project. At that point, FMC was run by a man named Paul Davies, who was a very aggressive acquirer of businesses. He didn't really have much interest in whether they were any good or not. He wanted numbers. After about a year, one morning, I lived in New York. I usually walked to work, and I frequently would have breakfast in the shrafts at in the basement of the Chrysler Building where the office was. And at that point, FMC, one of the directors was a man named Jan Oostermeyer. And Jan Oostermeyer had just retired as president of Shell Chemical. He was obviously a Dutchman. And we would not buy prearrangement, but accidentally meet there and have breakfast together occasionally. And one morning we met and had breakfast together and were reading the Wall Street Journal when there was an announcement that the government was going to sell the synthetic rubber plants. And this had required a special act of Congress. They had set up something called the Synthetic Rubber Plant Commission. They had appointed three well-known civilians to run the thing, had borrowed people from all the agencies, and they announced these sales. And we read this and decided, well, you know, if we want to go into some new business, here it is. We decided we should bid, and we looked down the list. And there were good reasons not to bid on most of the plants, because some of them were run by Exxon, by Goodyear, by Firestone, and you just felt there's no point bidding against them. But one was, there was a big butadiene plant that was being run by Sinclair Oil. And Sinclair has since been acquired by Arco. But even at that point, Sinclair was not a red hot operation. We thought that if we've got a chance to get any of these, the Sinclair one is the one. And so we put in a bid without any knowledge at all, but it was obvious that the bid didn't mean anything. The bid was just the beginning of a long negotiation process. And we bid $8 million, because that was a number we thought was respectable, but not enough that they'd give it to us automatically, because we didn't know what we'd do. And this started a long negotiation process with this rubber reserve. They called it the Rubber Reserve Commission. With that group, and I think that I probably negotiated, that I think the contracts we negotiated and I negotiated probably set the pattern for most of the others, because for some reason our deal sort of got in the front with, you know, with the lawyers. And so this lasted, this was almost a 6 or 8 month exercise. And I spent half my time in Washington. And a lot of the time over with these people. At that point, I'd never seen a butadiene plant. I had to go to the handbook, you know, to find out what it was and how you made it. But, you know, you learn as time goes on. And we were the successful bidder. And then simultaneously with that, Paul Davies was pretty much of a one-man show, and there was a man in Houston named Gardner Simons who ran something called Tennessee Gas, which is now Tenneco, and they had grown up together and were good friends and gone to the Harvard Business School together and were bosom friends, and they decided that they'd make this a joint venture between FMC and Tenneco, and we had a meeting the same day we closed the deal in Washington to set up the joint venture. And they had a long discussion about how we would operate, and I made a note at the time, which I found a long time later, but neither of them understood what the other one was saying. And so the thing started out without a good understanding. We set up a separate organization for Petronix. I went down to represent FMC. Tenneco put a man in, and they retained a guy named Joe Mayers, who had been a Monsanto vice president, to sort of be the, he was called the managing director, chairman or something, but he was relatively inactive. And within 6 months after we got started operation, maybe about that, first the business just took off. The rubber business picked up to a degree nobody ever expected. And so we started making a pot full of money. And the two principals, Davies and Simons, had a falling out and they never spoke to each other again until they both died, not speaking to each other. And they fell out over a very interesting thing that made no sense at all. We put in a Hoodry dehydrogenation unit. Butane was a feedstock, and at that time the only use for butane was to put it in gasoline in the wintertime to increase the vapor pressure. You didn't need it in the summertime, so there was a big market for butane in the winter, not much market, none in the summer. It wasn't a desirable home heating fuel. Propane was better. So butane would sell for 2 or 3 cents in the summertime. It was a drug on the market. Nobody had developed storage for it. And it might sell for 10 cents in the winter. Tenneco put in a butane recovery unit and was selling us butane. And we were paying them 6 cents a gallon for it, which was a reasonable year-round price. And Paul ran into someone he knew in the oil business and asked him what the price of butane was, and he said 3 cents. And that was the summertime. And Paul was paying, we were paying 6 cents, and that led to a discussion where both of them said things they probably were sorry for, but never, anyway. Petrotex. I stayed at Petrotex a long time. It was a very successful operation, but it clearly wasn't going anywhere because the two owners didn't get along.
Now that started 50. Was that 55?
Yes.
Okay, so there's that. Essentially, the 4-year period.
Was a 9-year period that I stayed at Petrotex.
Okay, but prior to that, then 51 to 55, you were with FMC. Is that right?
My guess is it's closer to 52 that I went to FMC, but I'm not
okay.
Sure. Anyway, I was with FMC looking for things for them, and at least a year of that I spent on this on Petrotex.
But that's a long 9-year period.
Well, it is, yeah. And in hindsight, I probably shouldn't have stayed there that long because it was a dead end kind of thing. Both FMC and Tenneco went their own ways, but I was happy. I married when I was 43. And I was happily married. We were comfortable in Houston, and I had nobody was bothering me much at Petrotex. So I stayed in the course of this, made 2 trips to India to set up to work on an Indian synthetic rubber plant, and this turned out to be an interesting thing too because. As you probably know, butadiene is made by dehydrogenating butane, It's also a byproduct of ethylene cracking and things like that. But during the war, because of some reason, someone had developed a process for making butadiene out of methanol. Are you an organic chemist? You converted acetaldehyde, you condensed the acetaldehyde into some four chain carbon thing and then dehydrogenate it. And there was a plant built up in Louisville, Kentucky to make butadiene out of alcohol. And it ran and made butadiene all during the war. The Indians decided they wanted a synthetic rubber business, and they invited Goodyear over to talk to them. And since Goodyear was our main customer, they asked me to go with them. So I went with them as the butadiene expert on this trip. And we spent a month in New Delhi and places around. And I've never run across anybody, any group of people who knew as little and thought they knew as much as the Indian bureaucrats that we had to deal with. They would tell me all about how to make butadiene and all about the economics, and they were determined to make butadiene out of alcohol up in northern India at a town called Bareilly. And we went to Bareilly, saw the site. That's where I saw the sulfur burner in the sugar mill there. And it was obvious that this was the wrong place to build it. It was the wrong raw material, the wrong process, wrong everything. And in the course of it, I met the Goodyear representative there. Had been the son of one of Nehru's close friends, so in the course of it, I got to meet Nehru several times. We went back 6 months later, spent another month there, and we decided to not fool with it. The thing was so badly conceived. Somebody else, Firestone, got involved in it and built it. The plant ran 5 years or so, and finally was shut down because it was obviously the wrong place, the wrong everything. But anyway, I probably should have left there sooner, but as I say, I was happy at home. I was not under any pressure. It was, and I might have just stayed there and coasted. But in 1964, Conoco, who was also headquartered in Houston at that point, the man who had been running their chemical business died suddenly of cancer and left them with no apparent successor. We had a consultant. We shared a consultant that would work for both Petrotex and Conoco named Herman Neuenhaus. I don't know if you've run across anything. Herman was a former Shell Dutchman who had a very successful consulting business in New York, mainly sort of bringing European technology to America and vice versa. Anyway, he is the one who made the connection between me and Conoco. Conoco at that point was run by a man named Lyndon McCollum, who was very much of an entrepreneur, and he and I got along. We met, got along fine. I went to work for them, stayed there for 6 years. When I went there, their chemical business was losing a few million dollars a year. When I left, it was, I don't remember, but it was probably making, the profits were probably more than the sales had been when I went there. He was very supportive of what I was doing, and we built We built a vinyl, we bought a vinyl fluoride PVC business, built a VCM plant, built an ethylene plant, had a operation in Germany, one in Spain, one in Japan. So it was really quite an interesting thing. And then,
and you were essentially managing the chemical.
I was running this business, and effectively, I did. You know, this was all things I did. Then, in 1968, my wife died of cancer after about a 2-year illness, and Mr. Mack retired, and the sort of the accountants types took over, and I decided at that point that I would do what I planned to do. And so in the middle of 1970, I left. And I left without any particular plans. I left on good terms with everybody, but I just decided it was time for me to move on. I came back to Houston, and the first thing that happened the day after I announced I was leaving, one of my investment banker friends called and said, "We invested in a company that's having trouble. Would you come look after it for a little while you're deciding what to do?" And that started a 6-year career of looking after about 3 or 4 high technology. There was a collision avoidance device for ships, a gas chromatograph company, a computer control company, nuclear chemical thing, and a company that made test gear for the Air Force.
In the 1975 Standard & Poor's Register lists you as, well, there's ATEC.
ATEC was one of the companies. That made the instrumentation that the Air Force uses in the test units for engines, where they, you know, they test engines.
Mm-hmm. There was the computer application technology, which.
Yes.
And then Iatron?
Iatron, that was a collision avoidance device for ships. And those have been acquired by other people. ATEC still is still running as a separate company and is moderately successful.
But some of these are, at this point, you're now getting away from the chemical business.
I know. So I spent 6 years out of the chemical business, which in hindsight probably was a good thing. Because when I went back in it, I had a sort of fresh point of view. And I went back in the chemical business. Petrotex, because of this joint ownership and because the owners didn't get along, slowly went downhill. Mainly because nobody would make any decisions. And so something had to be done about it, and they got together and asked me to come and run it. And so I agreed to run it if I got a free hand. The deal was that I would tell them what I was going to do. They would have 10 days or 2 weeks to tell me no, but if nobody said anything, I did whatever I planned to do. So I went into Petrotex, and at that particular point, it was losing a lot of money, and all the thought was, what can we do? Can we convert this into a storage facility and salvage some money? But it owed $35 million. It was making 800 million pounds of butadiene and losing money for a very simple reason. There was a lot of byproduct butadiene coming on the market. And so what Petrotex was doing is they lost more money, they'd make more butadiene. The more butadiene they made, the more they'd drive the price down. And so they were just digging their grave with their... And the first thing I did was to shut down 700 million pounds of this capacity, and we went from losing money making 800 million to making money making 100 million, because shutting down, the price went went back up. It went up to a reasonable number, and so it did. And then I also sold. They had very stupidly gotten into the neoprene rubber business, and we sold that to Dinka in Japan and paid off all the debt. So at the end of 2 years, Petrodex was doing well. Tenneco bought FMC out. They wanted me to stay and run it, but I didn't want to be a Tenneco employee. And almost simultaneously, a company in Houston called Alaska Interstate had had an operation in Alaska that distributed gas in Anchorage and southern Alaska, and so they were interested in Alaska. The state of Alaska announced that they were going to offer their royalty crude to anyone who would build a refinery slash petrochemical plant in Alaska, and the decision on who to award this would be based on who would do the most for the Alaskan economy, effectively who would create the most jobs. And a dozen people bid on this, and Alaska Interstate was bidding on it, and they had an all-out effort to do it. At that point, the chief counsel of Alaska Interstate was a good friend of mine. The chief financial officer was a friend. Some of the directors were friends, and they would occasionally call me in and ask me what I thought about this. And I forgot what I told them, but at any rate, the guy who was running this for him died suddenly of a heart attack. And they asked me to come in and hold it together, which I did, and then I got interested in it, agreed to stay, and I made a deal that this required the governor's approval. He had the governor and had to choose the right person, the right group, and the state legislature had to ratify it. And I agreed to stay through the state legislature ratifying it. They agreed to pay me a substantial bonus if I did it. And so I did, and had some fascinating experiences. Alaska is a great place. If I were young, I'd go there and stay. But dealing with the Alaska legislature was just like dealing with small town courthouse politics. We, at the last minute, in the course of time, the governor, we were chosen as the one, but we had to get approved by the legislature. The terms of the bill were such that if they didn't approve it at this session, the whole thing lapsed and started all over. Mm. And we got down to the last day of the legislature. The Senate ratified it. The House was still screwing around, and they started going home in anticipation of adjournment. We sent a plane to Fairbanks to bring two representatives back, and they wouldn't speak to each other. We had to send another plane to bring the other. Our lawyer, who's a very bright girl, woman, who's now the wife of Ted Stevens, the senator from Alaska, was our lawyer. She went on the plane and persuaded an Eskimo legislature to come off with his wife and mother-in-law and all their houseplants to come back and vote. We had one of our supporters in the Red Dog Saloon who got in such state that when he went to vote, he pushed the wrong button and voted against us. But we got it done. And then Alaska Interstate decided to sell this project to a company called Charter Oil, which was a sort of a high promotion operation in Florida. And I didn't want to get involved with them, so I took my bonus and pulled out and started thinking about what to do. And I decided the next thing for me to do was to buy a medium-sized chemical operation and sort of spend my last years looking after it and sort of semi-retirement. And so I started on this, And I tried three or four or five things. Gulf Oil at some point acquired a company called Harshaw Chemical.
Oh, yes.
About as illogical an acquisition as ever been made in history. Harshaw was a catalyst maker in the inorganic chemical business. This happened a number of years before, but by the early 80s, Gulf decided they wanted to sell it. I tried to buy it. A dozen people tried to buy it. Gulf consistently asked about 25% more than it was worth. A year later, they'd come back and offer it at a lower price, but still too much. And finally, they sort of merged it with Filtrol and probably got essentially nothing out of it. Well, that was one of my failures. I tried to buy a chemical business that Tenneco had that made plasticizers and things like that that Herxt bought. The closest I came was I was going to buy the Conoco carbon black business and the Phillips carbon black business and combine them into one business, and there were enough savings and research and overhead to pay for the thing doing it. And I got the thing all together. I had a deal signed with Conoco, and then Phillips backed out at the last minute because it would require them to show a loss because we weren't paying very much for it. And this came unglued. And along the way, I decided, well, hell, I quit fooling with these small things. And why don't I go back and try to buy the old chemical business that DuPont bought? And so, to back up a minute, on this Alaska deal, we had two bankers helping us. One was Lehman Brothers, and one was E.F. Hutton. And at that point, E.F. Hutton was not a powerhouse in the financial business, but the man they had on the job was exceptional. He was just much smarter than the Lehman people. And so we got to be friends, and when I started looking to buy something, I enlisted him to help me raise money. Well, I didn't need any money raising, but when I decided to approach DuPont, I knew the DuPont people, but I knew they wouldn't, if I walked in off the street, they wouldn't take me very seriously. And I'd kept up with this, to digress just a minute. One of the things I had in Conoco was a fourth interest in a company called PASA in Argentina, which at one point was the biggest petrochemical thing south of the equator. It made ethylene, ethylbenzene, styrene, butadiene, synthetic rubber. And when I left Conoco, it had always been a mess. It was started poorly financed, poorly managed, and when I got ready to leave, nobody in Conoco wanted to be responsible for it because they were afraid it would fold up. So I made a deal with Conoco to continue to represent them in Argentina, and so I went to Argentina every 6 or 8 months for 20 years, but it also kept me in touch with the chemical people, so I knew pretty much what was going on. So I decided to take a crack at DuPont and buying the chemical business from DuPont. And the man they assigned to work with me at Hutton turned out to be a good. His personal lawyer was a man named Joe Flom, F-L-O-M, who is sort of the dean of the acquisition lawyers in the world. And not only that, the former chairman of DuPont named Irv Shapiro had just joined Joe Flom's firm. So my friend in Hutton went to Joe Flom and told him what we wanted to do. He got Shapiro, and Shapiro set up a meeting for us, and then never was involved again. He set up a meeting with a man named Bob Richardson, who was one of the DuPont Executive Committee, and that's when this whole exercise I've been involved in now started. And we talked to him, and you know, we were probably guys off the street, and he was very polite, very nice. Told us at the time they would consider selling it, but they were not going to have an auction. They were going to enlist, have one other company make them an offer, a competitive offer. And he set up a procedure for us to work on, and this was in the fall of 82.
Working all right. I can usually monitor this to see if it's looks pretty good. All right, well then why don't we begin? I know that you were born on May 31st, 1912 in Baton Rouge. Could you tell me something about your parents and your family background?
Yes, my parents were both from Louisiana. My father started out in the university, in Louisiana State University. He intended to become a doctor, but the boll weevil, which was an insect that destroyed the cotton crop back in the early 1900s, broke his father, who had three children in the university at one time. Mm. And so my father, instead of going to medical school, got a degree in chemistry.
Really? At LSU.
He taught chemistry in high school for 1 year, then became a chemist for the State Department of Agriculture, and this was largely analytical work on fertilizer and things like that. And after 4 or 5 years of this, decided it was too confining, and became director of a state bare metal farm, and then later became what is called a county agricultural agent, which is a job of teaching farmers to farm. My mother also graduated from Louisiana State University, then when time, of course, there was never any question about where I would go to school. I was obviously going to go to LSU. The question was, what would I do? And I was making this decision in the middle of the Depression. I graduated from high school in 1928, and although officially people think about the crash starting in 1929, actually in the cotton growing country it started several years before that. So I think I decided early in the game that I wanted to do some form of science or engineering. I was good in math. I liked the limited amount of science I had in high school. And I looked around and found something that said that chemical engineers earned more money getting out of school than any other branch of engineering or science. And that's how I became a chemical engineer, instead of an electrical engineer or a physicist something else. I had, at that point, I'd never seen a chemical engineer in my life, and I didn't really know what one did.
What was your father's name?
His name was Gordon. We have different middle initials. His was Gordon D. Kane, and mine's Gordon A.
Did he have any influence in your decision to pursue chemistry, since he himself was a chemist?
I don't. Possibly. I'm sure. I'm sure the fact that he was a chemist was an influence on it. But as I say, I'd never seen a chemical engineer up to that point. The closest I'd come, there was a man in my hometown, which is a small cotton farming town, who was a sugar, what then was called a sugar engineer. He worked in the sugar mills in Louisiana all from September to December, January, then went to Latin America and worked until probably June or July, and came home and had a 2 or 3 month vacation. And I thought at the time that that was a great way to work. That was the closest to chemical engineering I came. But at that point, well, for a long time, LSU provided all of the a high percentage of all of the technologists for the sugar industry all over the world. There was something called the Audubon Sugar School, and it about a few years before I went to college, it was the Audubon Sugar School was converted to the Department of Chemical Engineering at LSU, and that's
I see.
That's how I got to be a chemical engineer.
Now you started at LSU. Yeah, what year?
In 1929.
I
worked a year between high school and college as a clerk on the Missouri Pacific Railroad. I was just 16 when I graduated, and so I worked for a year and got money to go to college.
Where did you grow up? In Baton Rouge?
No, I grew up in a small town. I grew up in two small towns in Louisiana. One is where the experimental farm was, which is a town named Calhoun in North Louisiana, and then the rest of the time in one named Rayville, which is in the northeast corner of Louisiana, in the flat, rich Mississippi Delta land, where largely a cotton farming part of the world.
What was it like growing up there as a child?
I doubt if it's much different from growing up anywhere else at that particular time. Of course, the things you remember about it are that, you know, I don't remember thinking about any of the problems that are current today. Drugs were just a word. There was an occasional town drunk, but alcohol wasn't a significant problem. Crime was so rare that you talked about it for days and days afterward. And I grew up in pretty much the kind of growing up I think any small town person did in the 20s.
It strikes me as being somewhat unusual. Both your parents, at the time we're talking about, that both your parents were college graduates.
Yes. Well, it was. Now, my grandparents were not college graduates, but they were both very well-read people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were in a part of a culture where knowing Latin and Greek, they knew Latin and Greek, and my father did too. Not from college, but from growing up. There was a period and a section of that part of the world where men of any background just sort of automatically knew Latin and Greek, and I think they learned from tutors, And so I remember that about I remember that my father's father was a very well-read man, but I don't think he ever went to any higher learning.
Had his family been in Louisiana a long time?
Yes. My family heritage, my ancestry is almost entirely Scotch-English, and what is sometimes called Scotch-Irish, which were the Scots who went to Ireland and stayed a few generations and then immigrated to this country. I mean, they're what is now the North Irish.
Mm-hmm.
So my ancestry was largely Scots. And they, for the most part, immigrated to this country in the 1700s, settled in the Carolinas and then slowly worked their way eastward and southeast.
I see. You know. So you really went to college in the, as you said, the Depression had started earlier in the cotton country, and so when you got, it happened right after you started.
That's right. It was I was there during the Depression, and it cost me about a maximum of $500 a year to go to, total expenses to go to school, part of which I made in the summertime, part of which I made working, part of which my family gave me, part of which I borrowed. So, you know, I was a typical depression child or depression student.
I imagine there must have been a number of people who couldn't finish going to college at that time.
Well, there were, and there were a number of them who would drop out for a semester and come back.
Okay.
And very few of the men I graduated with, probably less than half of them, had gone through four straight years as I did. Many of them had started two or three years before that, and dropped out for a semester to work or something. And there were included in them were a number of people who had graduated as chemists earlier and came back to take chemical engineering. Many of these were these sugar people who had gone out in the sugar chemists.
Mm-hmm.
And the sugar industry went to hell about that time, and so at least a third of my classmates were people who had done that and had come back to take chemical engineering.
What was your reaction when you got there? You said you had never seen a chemical engineer, and here you are in a chemical engineering curriculum.
I know. Well, you know, the first thing I saw, there was a demonstration sugar mill on the campus, and that, and of course, being in the fall, it was, and it operated. And so this was my first sight of any sort of chemical process, was the grinding of sugar cane and the conversion of sugar. And probably my first year, I went out to a real sugar mill and saw it. And it was about as, I couldn't understand the place of a chemical engineer in the thing, because this was about as unscientific an operation there as you can imagine. It was an old Cajun sitting with a kerosene lantern and a glass slide, and he would pull samples out of the evaporator to see if the crystals were forming properly. And he was the sole, I mean, he and his experience were the sole control, because you could, if you ran the evaporator improperly, you could make the sugar into syrup,
mm-hmm.
and get no crystals at all. And so he was he with his kerosene lantern, his last slides, was the guy who controlled what sort of sugar this thing made.
That's interesting. There are a couple things I wanted to ask you about the LSU department. Was chemical engineering a separate department from chemistry?
It was a separate department. At that point, it was sort of half in the engineering school and half they had a school of applied science. It was sort of a bastard operation or a hybrid operation. And the chemistry faculty were probably much more dominant in the chemical engineering school than the engineering faculty was, largely because there was a Dean Coates, who had been dean of the sugar school for 20, 30, or 40 years, and he pretty much dominated the school, the chemical engineering department.
Mm-hmm. Because in 1929, chemical engineering was still a young discipline.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't only been a couple, maybe 10, 20 years that it had become a real separate discipline.
Yes, I know. And, of course, we start out with the Walker Lewis and Mac Adams text.
Yes.
And I think every chemical engineer, at least at that point, started.
Mm-hmm. What was your curriculum like at the beginning? You took chemistry?
Well, as I remember, all engineers took the same thing for the first year.
Okay.
There were minor variations the second year. And in terms of the current chemical engineering curriculum, our curriculum was much more heavily chemical because I took quantitative and qualitative analysis, which I don't think chemical engineers mm-hmm. take anymore. And I took 2 years of organic chemistry.
Wow.
Yes. Which, and a year of physical chemistry. And I think I even took a second year of physical chemistry. But even at the time, I think, even by the then standards, it was more heavily chemical than average, and certainly much more heavily chemically oriented than the current curriculum is. And I graduated in 1933, okay. right after the bank holiday, and all the banks were closed for anywhere from a week to 2 or 3 months, or some of them forever. And I lived my last few months in college on cafeteria meal checks. Nobody had any money. The university let you sign for meal tickets in the cafeteria, and these things became the medium of exchange for the campus, and even the business, the businesses around the campus took them. So everybody finished on credit and using these cafeteria meal checks to live on.
Can you tell me something about some of the faculty there?
Yes. Probably the dominant member of the faculty was a Professor Coates, Charles Coates, who, as I say, had been, and at that time he was probably a little past retirement age. I would guess that when I graduated he must have been 70 or 73 or 4. Maybe even a little older, and he had run this Audubon Sugar School for a long, long time. Was a recognized figure in the sugar chemistry and chemistry business. The rest of the chemical faculty, the only. The ones I remember were Dr. Menville was an organic chemistry professor, and Arthur Chopin was a physical chemistry teacher. The chemical engineering professor, there was only one chemical engineering professor, and his name was Paul Horton, H-O-R-T-O-N. And at that juncture, he didn't have any assistants. I think there were no assistant professors. He had graduate assistants with the great papers, but that was it. And he was a man who was very aloof with his students. And after I graduated, I became very fond of him. He felt some need to maintain distance with his students, and once you graduated, you sort of got into a different category, and I learned to like and was very fond of him. And but in the class that I graduated with, there were only 13 chemical engineers. This was the Depression. At the time I graduated, there were not a single corporate recruiter showed up on the campus that year. I think for any of the engineering school, none of my classmates had a professional job. A lot of the petroleum engineers had got laboring jobs in the oil field, some of the chemical engineers got jobs as sample boys in the refineries, where they rode around on a bicycle and collected samples from the tank farm. I didn't have a job when I graduated. I had a fellowship to go back to school, and I would have gone back. I didn't particularly want to go. Well, I was torn. The idea of going to graduate school was attractive, and I think I would have liked it and been very happy at it. But I'd been going to school with working part time, borrowing money part time. I was in debt. I had two brothers coming into university at the same time. I couldn't take any more money from my parents with them having two more in college, and I had a great desire to go to work, but I couldn't find a job. A week before I was to go back to the university to take my graduate fellowship, I heard of a man who had graduated a few years before I did, who I knew just slightly. He had been probably a senior when I was a freshman, who had a job and wanted to go to graduate school. So I went to see him at his job, and went to see his boss, and got the dean of the college on the telephone, and on the phone we made a trade. We traded my fellowship for his job. Neither one of us, he wouldn't give up the job until he was sure he could get the fellowship. I wouldn't give up the fellowship until I was sure I could get the job. It was a lousy job that I got, but it paid reasonably well for that point. It was working in a big central steam generating station, power station.
That's Louisiana Power and Light.
And I was sort of a combination boiler feed water chemist, instrument mechanic, efficiency calculator, and it said I was an engineer, but I spent more time in work clothes than I did in anything else. And it was a kind of job that, other than the fact that the salary was fairly good by the time, that you wouldn't want to stay on any longer than you have to. And it took me a while to find another job, which was with the Freeport Sulphur Company.
In your LSU training, what kind of laboratory facilities did they have? Did you have much practical experience to use later?
Probably more, I think, than average because of the sugar. Because this was not a miniature mill. I'm not sure what you call it. Much more than a pilot plant. It had almost full-scale equipment, and there was the agricultural experimental station there was raising sugarcane enough to run the mill. So we ran this sugar mill every fall for two or three months. Now that was the only practical. All the practical experience we got was tied up with that, but the students ran it completely, and so we got more than just an onlooking kind of experience. But that was, and then Baton Rouge, for its time, had more chemical industry around it than many places. There was a big SO, Standard Oil of Louisiana, now Exxon refinery there, and a number of satellite sulfuric acid plants and things like that around it. So there was probably more opportunity for field trips than many places.
Did you feel comfortable in your selection of chemical engineering as you went through LSU?
Yes, I did. I was happy with the selection.
How did you? You said you spent those 2 years at
at the power company sort of biding your time,
yes,
because you had an income. How did you make your connection with Freeport Sulfur?
Well, one of my classmates went to work there, and I guess he got a job maybe a few months after I did, and called me and told me that if I showed up, he was sure they would hire me. And I did, and they did. And so I drove down to Freeport, Texas, and went to work for Freeport. And this turned out to be a very good experience. First, it was a good company. You know, the people were honorable and good people. And there were a number of things going on, a lot of activity going on, and I spent, I have to think now, six very, very pleasant and worthwhile years at Freeport. At first, I was involved in the operations sort of things. We started something that would have been mandatory now, and that was the reuse of the bleed water that came from the formation. After you put hot water down to melt the sulfur, the water put down has to go somewhere. And at that point, it was just going out into the local prairie, and not because of any environmental reasons, but to reuse the heat. We can develop techniques for reusing it. Then Freeport was involved in a manganese operation in Cuba, and I went down to Cuba and spent about nearly a year working on the beneficiation process for manganese, which was flotation. And this was, for somebody who had not been out of it, between my junior and senior year, I went on an ROTC camp up in Edgewood Arsenal, Maryland, and that was my one time I'd been more than 100 miles away from the lower Mississippi River. And so the idea of going to a place like Cuba for a year was fascinating, and I had a great time there working on developing this flotation process to recover manganese ore. I came back and I went then to...
What was it like in Cuba at that time?
This, you see, was 37, 38, something like that. Cuba was a very pleasant place at that point. We were just north of Santiago, about 15 or 20 miles from Santiago. There probably were not more than, we were a group of maybe 10 Americans, and there were probably not more than 10 Americans in the whole section around there. The people were very friendly. I joined a golf club. I joined the beach club in Santiago. I had a great time there. And the Cubans were very friendly. And I had the unusual experience for a young man of that time of having dates with a duenna along, where an old aunt or somebody came along whenever if you took a girl anywhere.
Were you paid American wages?
Financially, I did quite well, and we lived in a sort of mining camp, and it didn't cost much to live. And then I came back and went out prospecting for molybdenum in Nevada, in the north end of Death Valley, and it was interesting too, because our headquarters were a town of Goldfield, which back in 19 well it had several distinctions. One in the early 1900s, it had 30,000 people and streetcars and stock exchanges. At this point, it had 60 people, a population of 60. It has a black mark in labor history because it was one of the places that President Roosevelt used federal troops to break a strike.
Mm.
And the strike was over a very interesting issue that doesn't come up anymore. And that was whether the miners had to change clothes after they came off shift or not, because the custom was to fill their boots with gold, with high-grade gold dust, and carry it out. And they tried to impose a clothes-changing policy, and that caused the strike. But it was an interesting place to live, an interesting experience.
Freeport Sulphur was involved in much more than just sulphur.
Yes, they were involved. They had aspirations to be a mining company, and they were in the manganese mining business in Cuba. They wanted to develop other mining operations. That was the only one that the manganese one was the only one that was successful. The molybdenum, we were taking samples on a big molybdenum prospect in the north end of Death Valley in a place called Alum Gulch. And it was a very interesting thing. There was a big exposed cliff about 1,000 feet high and maybe a mile or two across, and was almost pure molybdite on the surface.
Mm.
And it, you know, you just thought there must be tremendous amounts behind that, but we took samples from the top and drove tunnels in the side, and what had obviously happened, all the molybdenum that had ever been there had leached out and deposited on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a tremendous deposit, 1,000 feet by a couple of miles and an eighth of an inch thick. But the prospects were so intriguing that we spent a lot of money and time doing it. But it, for me, it was a great experience and a great time.
Who were some of the people you were working with at that time?
Most of them have gone on to other things. One was a geologist named Ralph Taylor, who subsequently worked and I think eventually retired as a sort of the geologist with Exxon in charge of their non-oil geological kind of things, because I think Exxon went through a phase of wanting to get into non-oil things. And I've really forgotten most of the names.
But you had a mixture of backgrounds then.
Oh yes, yes. The others were mining engineers,
mm-hmm.
and I was the chemist, and did all the sampling and that kind of thing.
When did you come back from Nevada then?
I think my recollection is that I spent most of 1940, I spent 38 in Cuba, most of 1940 in Nevada. And I came back from Nevada probably in late 1940, attended a AICHE meeting in New Orleans, probably January of 40, sat next to a man who was director of engineering for Murray at a luncheon. And I think at that particular point I had very interesting assignments, and it looked like I was going to probably get stuck back in Freeport on some fairly routine kind of job. And he asked me if I wanted to come and work in Murray Engineering. And at that point, Murray, they just authorized the fortification of flour and bread with vitamins. The antibiotics were just coming in. The war was developing in Europe. Merck was building sulfa drug, synthetic vitamin plants just as fast as they could. And I went to Merck to work in designing and building those as a project engineer, building those. And I must have built three or four nicotinic acid plants, several sulfa drug plants. Toward the end of my stay at Merck, Merck got involved in penicillin, and one of Dr. Fleming's assistants came to Merck. I think it was a Dr. Heatley, and he was a rather shy bachelor in a strange town, and we had apartments in the same building. And
this was in Rahway.
In Rahway. And he, you know, brought the technology for making penicillin. And just before I left work, I designed that they were growing penicillin in flask and extracting it in the laboratory. And I designed a 4-inch Pyrex column to extract penicillin from the laboratory flask, and it made about a dose of penicillin an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of the beginning of penicillin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But at that point, the war was going on. I'd gone to an ROTC school. Merck would have kept me out, but this was the biggest thing that was going to happen in my lifetime, and I wanted to see what's going to be in it. So I went in the Army on St. Patrick's Day, 1942.
You enlisted then?
Well, I was called as
ROTC.
Went to a sort of officer's pool outside of Washington, and I sat around for about 2 weeks when people would come in and interview me to see if they wanted me to work in their munition plant or their chemical warfare plant or whatever. And it made no sense to me to leave a good, and most of these guys were, most of it at that point, were people who had gotten in a year or two before because it was the best job they could find. And most of them were people I wouldn't want to work for. So I was successfully discouraged all of them from taking me. And apparently there was a rule that if you weren't chosen in 2 weeks, you got shipped out. And I got shipped to Panama. And in Panama, it looked like I was going to get some sort of supply job. And I heard of a job that was open, and I asked for it, which is sort of contrary to the normal Army procedure. But this was this commanding officer of an old regular Army heavy mortar company, I'd been in the ROTC, I'd been in the infantry. But sometime just before my junior year, something came out that said any chemical engineer wants to transfer to the chemical warfare service can, and you can go to camp, ROTC camp, between your junior and senior year in Maryland. And this is how I made my one trip and went to New York in the course of it. But I became join the Chemical Warfare Service to get this trip to the East Coast. And so I was in the Chemical Warfare Service, got down there, and the Chemical Warfare Service had done one good thing, and that is they had developed a mortar, which, as you know, is a high angle of fire. That was much more accurate than any of the infantry, any of the other mortars that were developed. And it shot about a 40-pound shell, and it had been originally developed to shoot white phosphorus and things like that, and it was been converted to an infantry weapon. And this was an old regular Army company, and I became commanding officer of it, the first non-regular Army officer they had ever seen. The youngest man in the unit was on his second enlistment. Some of them had 25 or 30 years service. It was an interesting experience to take over something like that, and I learned fast. And in the course of time, we stayed there a year. In the course of this, I got up as a sideline job, installed a smoke screen around the canal. And then we came back to the States, were expanded into a battalion, and got 1,000 draftees off the train one Labor Day, I guess, 43, and trained that winter, went to the Pacific, and spent the rest of the war in the Pacific.
Mm. Where in the Pacific were you at?
Well, we landed, we were in Hawaii first, the battalion started getting broken up, and different parts of it going to different places, and they went to Saipan, Guam, Peleliu. Then we went together, got back together on Leyte, and the first landing on Leyte, and then landed on Okinawa. And after the Okinawa landing, had come back to Leyte and had already loaded on ships to land in Japan when the war was over.
So you were really in the thick of things for a number of years.
Yeah, I was. For a couple of years, I was in pretty much the... We landed, about 30 or 40 minutes after anybody landed, and gave close support to the infantry, because we could get our mortars ashore much easier and faster than you could get artillery ashore. So we were among the first going.
Any particular experiences from those two years?
You have lots of experiences.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back a little bit, both to time just before you went to Merck.
Yeah.
I found two things from 1939. One, a publication you had, and another, a patent. With somebody by the name of Chatelaine.
Chatelaine, yes.
And I was curious about the one publication in Chemical and Metallurgical Engineering about low-capacity sulfur burners.
Oh, well, that, yes. I invented a sulfur burner. There was a need at that point for a sulfur burner that you could control. There were lots of sulfur burners, but you put sulfur in and burned them, and there was very little control of them. Now, the particular need for which I built this was in water treating. In the course of treating this particular water, it got too alkaline. And so you had to acidify it. And so instead of using sulfuric acid, I had the idea, well, we will burn sulfur, and it also removed oxygen. It acidified the water and removed oxygen. It was a great idea. And I designed this little burner where the amount of sulfur you burn was determined just by the amount of air you put through it. By changing the airflow, you could change that. And I got several interesting things about that. One, in the course of this, I went out to the sewage department at at Phoenix, Arizona, and helped them install a wall. But the most interesting one I've ever had was, and some guy who was, and I don't remember any names, some guy who was developing and printing all the films for the studios in Hollywood had trouble getting sodium thiosulfate, and he decided he wanted to make sodium thiosulfate. So I went out and helped him develop a burner so he could make sodium thiosulfate. I think he made it maybe for a few years and then, or maybe months, and then someone started making it for him. But for some reason, at that particular point, he was having great trouble getting, and that was also one of the required reagents in developing film. That was my one Hollywood experience. But the thing I remember about it was that he took me to about the second night of Gone with the Wind.
Really?
Not the opening night, but about the second or third night of Gone with the Wind. But that, the other thing is that years later, I was in India on a trip connected with Petrotex, and visited a sugar mill there, and they were using one of my burners up in the in northern India, within the sight of the Himalayas.
Like it. Who was Chatelain? Was he?
He was the classmate at LSU who had gotten me to come there. And the last time I heard of him, he was in ill health somewhere in South Louisiana.
The other patent there was is titled "Liquid Mixture Suitable for Use in Drilling Wells."
Kind of almost forgotten what that was.
The only note I have is a drilling fluid that contains molten sulfur
glycol. Okay. Yes, and this turned out to be interesting for different reasons. At that particular point in the oil drilling business, they were having trouble with something called heaving shale, now, which was a shale formation which, when water hit it underground, it swelled. And so there was a need for an anhydrous drilling fluid, and there were a lot of people trying to use oil-based drilling fluids, and that you never get them anhydrous enough, but what these things didn't, you drill into them, they would swell and close the hole. And as you probably, do you know anything about drilling oil wells?
Just a little bit.
Well, what you have is you've got a bit, and the drilling is really done by a mud that is circulated through the bit, and it carries the cuttings up out of the hole. Well, it provides several functions. It cools and lubricates it, but it also sort of incidentally sort of builds up a little coat, on the side of the, that helps sort of keep the hole open. Well, they were running into places where they had this anhydrous shale that when water hit it, it would swell and close the hole, the idea of using molten sulfur as a drilling fluid, other people had tried this, but the thing that was wrong with it is that molten sulfur has very peculiar thermal characteristics. It is very fluid right at the melting point, but if you heat it much past the melting point, it gets very, very viscous. It goes through a very viscous stage. So if you heated it hot enough to keep it from cooling off, it was too viscous to pump. And I developed something, it was a thiocol type material to go in the sulfur to reduce the viscosity at this higher temperature. And we drilled one well with it, and maybe another one, but I only remember one, and I think by that time somebody developed better ways to handle this shale problem, but it never didn't revolutionize it.
Your experiences with Freeport Sulphur up to this point were quite varied then. How did
they
you
were.
Get these different assignments, or did you select something?
Well, first I did. Second, I was single. Most of my contemporaries were married. And, you know, somehow if you're single and willing to go, and there are married guys who don't want to go to Cuba for a year, you collect those assignments, and that's basically why I did. I wanted to do it, and I was free to do it.
It must have been quite a change then going to Merck, where now you're in plant design.
Yeah, because well, it was. And it was a very interesting change because nobody was interested in anything but Merck except getting these things built as fast as you can. I don't ever remember making a cost estimate. I remember being under lots of pressure about time schedules, but nobody worried about money. And so you just had a free hand to do almost whatever you wanted to as long as you got them built and made them run. And so it was a completely different experience. And it was a time when I worked very hard. We worked long hours because there was a lot of pressure to get things done there. And Merck too was Merck is a great company now, and it was a good company then. It was at least this part of Merck was run almost entirely by scientists. The research people really dominated, mm-hmm. and they had some very fine research people.
How did Merck react to your wishing to join the military as opposed to staying there?
They objected a little bit, but when it was apparent that I really wanted to do it, then they quit. And we even, in effect, negotiated a time for me to leave. They arranged with the Army for me to stay until I finished whatever I was working on. And I left after that.
Now, you didn't leave the military until 46, is that correct?
Well, that's when I officially left. I left. I'd been overseas most of the time. I had lots of accumulated leave. So I really left the military about November 45. And I came, landed in San Francisco, and I decided I wanted to get my career thing settled before I took any vacation. Came to New York, talked to Merck, and whatever they offered didn't seem very exciting. Freeport at that point professed to want to make some and get in a major expansion, and wanted to do something in what we would now call the petrochemical business. And I went to work for them with the idea of getting them into some major expansion of their business, very likely in the petrochemical part of it.
Well, by this time, Dow had already had its Freeport facilities.
Yes, Dow, that was really the start of it, but Dow's original start was in magnesium.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the day I left Freeport to go to work for Merck is the day the first magnesium, Dow produced the first magnesium. I was in the local cafe eating breakfast in preparation for leaving when two or three Dow people brought in the first ingot of magnesium to show to all the local people. But Dow's petrochemical activities came some, I guess they came later in the war.
Yes, because they were producing styrene there during the war.
Yeah. Okay.
And
yes,
I think that was their first big facility there was the styrene.
Yeah.
So by the time you returned, Dow was a principal force in Freeport.
Yes, they were. I didn't come back to Freeport. I came back to New York. I went to work in New York.
I see.
Yeah.
What were your first responsibilities with them then when you went to New York?
Well, my first responsibility really was to find things for them to do this way.
Okay.
And somewhere in the Freeport file, you can find reports of mine recommending that they do, at one time or another, almost everything that has been done on the Gulf. You know, the course that Carbide took, that Monsanto took. But the problem with Freeport was that sulfur business was so good that nothing you did looked good in comparison to it. So this was just a series of good ideas. They weren't quite good enough to, they didn't look good compared to what they were doing. But I, one of the first things I did, or not close to the first, was to go to Germany on one of these Fiat missions to Germany. I spent probably five or six months in Germany on one of the technical missions. And
what was Germany? This would have been what then? 46.
Yeah.
What was? And well, that was Germany, right in the war it ended.
But yes. Well, Germany was in terrible shape. Peter Spitz, you know Peter Spitz?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Peter's written a book that includes some of this.
Okay.
And there was, after the, you know, there were two things that are, might be interesting. One, there was something called the Strategic Bombing Survey. Have you run across that?
I think I've heard the name, but that's...
Okay, well, this was something right after the war, and by right after, I mean days or weeks after the war. There was a group of American engineers and technicians sent over to see what damage had been done by the strategic bombing. And this included a number of people that you probably might want to talk to, except that I've forgotten who they were, but they were well-known engineers and technicians. Probably as a result of that, or maybe not as a result, there was something called the Fiat, and God, and I can't remember what was set up, but it was an agency. There was a group that was set up to study German industry to see what things they had that would be useful to us. And it was headquartered where is the Hoechst headquarters?
It's not Ludwigshafen, is it?
No, it's out of Frankfurt.
I don't remember offhand.
Yeah, the Griesheim was the next place, but it was one of the semi-suburbs and it's where at least at that point, the Hoechst headquarters were. And this was a semi-military operation. We wore uniforms, but not any officers insignia, and had something, a patch that said scientific consultant.
Mm.
And we were supposed to be treated like officers of some indefinite rank. And we lived in the Army officers, when we traveled, we lived in Army officers' quarters, and we traveled out of transportation provided by the motor pools, and we had to write reports on what we did. And I was over there interested in two things, acetylene from methane, and sulfur processes generally. And I wrote, and jointly with a DuPont director, what they call the Jackson Lab, a guy named Nick Carter, and his name was not Nicholas, it was Nick was a nickname, and I've forgotten what his initials were, but Nick and I spent a lot of time studying the SOXY process for converting methane to acetylene. And this is pretty much the process that I guess Tenneco used, that Monsanto at one point used and abandoned, where you have a furnace in which you heat methane and convert part of it into acetylene. Is a great company, but they're not noted for speed, and so things moved fairly slowly. And because we would ask for information, it would be weeks before we'd get it back, and then it wouldn't be quite what we wanted, we'd ask again. But this thing started probably in September or October.
Exactly.
Of 82, and in June of 83, DuPont said, well, we had to make an offer. We made an offer at the time, and after a little fiddling around, they accepted it. And we offered $600 million for the business, subject to adjustments, inventory, and all sorts of things like that. And we spent the next, but this was all verbal, and we spent 3 months writing a fairly simple letter of intent. Again, mainly because of the slow reaction. I mean, so we signed a letter of intent about October of 83, and up to that time, they hadn't let us talk to the management. So at this point, they let us talk to the management, and we had a major problem in that there were all sorts of ties between the Lake Charles refinery and the Lake Charles petrochemical complex. They used joint barge loading facilities. The steam systems were intertwined. The power systems were intertwined. We took kerosene from the refinery. We extracted the straight chain hydrocarbons. We sent the raffinate back to the refinery. And there were over 30 contracts that had to be worked out. And I decided the thing to do is to let the management work this out. So one the morning of the 1st of November, I was jogging up on the roof, and I felt some sharp pains in my gut. And I'd slow down and go away. I'd speed up, and I knew pretty well what was there. Well, 2 days later, I was having open heart surgery, and when I started recovering, I'd be checking on the phone to see what was going on, and it was obvious nothing was going on. The management and the refinery people couldn't get along, and they couldn't settle anything because they'd been fighting with each other over this sort of thing for a long time. It was the first time the refinery people had the ability to be difficult. And our people, the management probably was difficult. And so the first time I was able to travel was right after Christmas. And we went to Wilmington, and DuPont said, if you don't get this all settled within 30 days, we're going to pull out. And I made a deal with them for them to assign some senior people to negotiate, because we've been dealing with two low-level people, and this part of it got moved along. And a month later, we hadn't finished, but we'd gone so far that, and I got back in it myself, we'd gone so far that they were happy. And then we started having problems in another area. We had gotten banks to agree to put up part of the money, we'd gotten the Prudential Insurance Company and a group of insurance companies to put up the subordinated debt. And everything seemed to be moving along very well. And sometime about February or March, the Federal Reserve wrote a letter to all banks saying, we want to report on the high leverage transactions you're engaged in. And some banks disregarded as a request for information. Others decided the sky is falling and we have to run for cover. And we had two banks that were our lead banks, Manufacturers Hanover and Bankers Trust. And Bankers Trust just decided the sky was falling and announced they were pulling out of, Good Friday morning, DuPont, in the course of this, would every 2 or 3 weeks would check with Prudential and the banks, see if everything was in order. Good Friday morning, they called the banks and everybody was in order. That afternoon, Bankers Trust called and said they were pulling out of the deal, which just everything folded up. And so we would have been dead in the water and the thing would have fallen apart, except that this had gone on so long that DuPont decided, not because they wanted to make this deal, but because they didn't want to waste all this time and do nothing, that they'd give us some help. So they put out word among the banks that DuPont wanted this thing to go through. And they signed a piece of paper that said guarantee at the top, and DuPont signed at the bottom, and their lawyers wrote in between practically nothing. It guaranteed some of our debt to a limited extent under some unusual circumstances, but the only thing that happened was that DuPont had indicated to the financial community they wanted this to go, and so our bankers went back together, and from then on it was just a matter of putting together the legal things, and we got it closed in July, and that started Vista Chemical. And then along the way, before that, I decided that doing deals like this was more fun than running a chemical company. And a young man that I'd run across before, who was bright and able and had been doing mergers and acquisitions for a local firm, asked me to, his firm went out of business, or rather his the principal had a heart attack and had to give up the business, and so he asked me to sort of help him take it over, and I did. And he has done sort of LBOs separate from me, but I mean sort of under my wing, but in smaller things. Then sometime, I guess in the fall of 85, when I was chairman of the board of Vista, I heard that the Texas City plant was for sale. Called Monsanto and found it was for sale. They were already talking to dozens of people about buying it, to Amoco, to Standard Bohau, and I got involved in it, got all the data, made an offer. By this time, I'd sort of outgrown Hutton, and they were having trouble internally. The people that I'd worked with had moved on to other things, so I went forward on my own and found it raising money like this wasn't a big job. And the key to our doing the Texas City deal was that we made acetic acid, acrylonitrile, styrene, plasticizers, and a few odds and ends. And we needed some sort of contract to give us some support, and nobody wants to sign a styrene or a acrylonitrile contract. But the idea occurred that BP is big in acetic acid everywhere but in the United States, and they might want to get in the acetic acid business. And so we approached them and very quickly made a deal under which they underwrote a lot of the financing in return for us effectively turning the acetic acid business over to them. of really doing a very elaborate toll processing deal with them. So that let us finance Sterling Chemical.
I've read somewhere that, well, I mean, in these LBOs, and that's certainly in the period you're talking about, that was certainly a lot of activity.
Yeah.
In all areas, but yours, the Vista was the first one in the chemical industry. But part of an LBO, as I understand it, is that you end up selling off part of the assets, and
well,
you didn't do that.
I didn't do that, and that's not a necessary part of it. A lot of people did that, but that wasn't my style. And the other thing we consistently did was not cut anybody's wages, not cut benefits. We commit right up front that we're going to maintain the same wages and benefits. I've been lucky in some regards, and that is that except the Vista, all of the subsequent things I did, the seller didn't want to sell anything but the assets, and did not want to turn loose any staff except plant managers and below. So I did not have any requirement to take upper level staff, which made things very easy, because we've consistently run with about a third or a fourth the overhead the predecessors ran with, and run better. And so Sterling Chemical, that plant had not made any money for a number of years, and if we hadn't made the BP contract, we would never financed it. But with the BP contract, we were able to finance it. And the styrene business turned around within two or three months after we closed the deal, and the prices went up, and we paid off all the debt within 87. 2 years later, we were out of debt and declared a big dividend, and then went public, which was a mistake. We should not. This is too cyclic a business to be a public company. We should never have gone public, and that was one of the mistakes that I think was made. But one of the things I've done consistently in this is to insist that all the key people buy stock. We put in stock option plans, but in addition, I wanted them to be at risk. I wanted to have not just a win-win situation, but one where if things went bad, they had to buckle down and help. And we put in ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans. And I would say in the four deals very successful deals that I've done, every key man, and by this I mean people earning from 60,000 up, is now a millionaire. They've made over $1 million. The employees can have from out of their ESOP from 3 to 4 to 5 times annual salary in the ESOP. We'll have that when they leave, when they retire. So, but about a year after the Sterling Chemical, which is a Texas City deal, I had known that there was a plant, an ethylene plant down in Corpus Christi, and I'd known, you know, the chemical business is a gossipy business, and everybody knows pretty much what's going on. And everybody knew that the owners, Solvay, Union Pacific, and ICI were not happy with it. And they even hired a guy named Jack St. Clair, who was a former president of Shell Chemical, to sell it for them, although they would never admit they were selling it. And I would talk to Jack, and they had financed it with all totally borrowed money, but with guaranteed by their parents. And they were not making enough money to pay off the loan, so the owners were paying off the loan, and they were determined not to sell it for less than the unpaid loan. It wasn't worth that. And I probably talked to Jack first about this around 82 or 3, and about once a year I checked with him, and the loan had gone down, but the value of the plant still wasn't up, and So about 86, the value of the loan had gone down to the point I thought it was worth, probably worth it, and set out to buy it, and started negotiating with them. And on all these things, you try not to get too far ahead of whoever's going to supply the money. So I talked to Chase, who I thought would finance it, and they said, well, it's very, maybe you can convince us that the ethylene business is going to turn around, because at that point it was losing money and had for years, but we won't finance a one plant, one product operation. Go find something else. So I started looking around, called DuPont about half of a glycol plant they own, and they said, well, it's for sale, but we're much more interested in talking to you about three polyethylene plants and an ethylene plant. And so I started talking to DuPont about that, started talking to PPG about the other half of the glycol plant, to ICI about their glycol plant. And the only one I was failed on was that I could buy all of the polyethylene thing, but I never was successful in buying the DuPont half of the glycol plant, because it was in a different group at DuPont, and they just were not, well, I don't know, I couldn't make a deal with them. But anyway, we wound up putting together seven ethylene-related plants into something called Kane Chemical. And we did it just as the ethylene business was turning around. This first month this Corpus Christi plant ever made money was the month we bought it. It's just blind luck. Along the way, I had to convince banks, though, that this was going to happen.
This early test that you said earlier before, that said you would be a good salesman, must be pretty accurate then, because of your ability to do just what you've said.
The main selling was to sell people and putting up the money. Kane Chemical just took off like a rocket, and we of the five key people, we didn't take any overhead people. We took a few low-level overhead people, but Bill McMinn, who had been at FMC, was the president. We got a man from Carbide to run the, John Lutzinger, to run the polyethylene business. The man that I'd worked with at Petrotex to run the hydrocarbon part of the business. We persuaded an ARCO, a fairly high ARCO treasurer, to leave ARCO and join us as financial officer. And somehow I got started here in Sterling Chemical, hiring. And when we put Sterling Chemical together, there was a young, bright young lawyer, very successful in one of the law firms here, that didn't work on my deal, but just wanted to leave the law and go into business. So he left and joined Sterling Chemical and did and sort of as the chief counsel and vice president of everything that nobody else is doing. I did the same thing at Kane Chemical, the same thing at Fiber Industries, and so I staffed these people from outside, but mostly people I had some tie to and knew something about. And almost exactly this time, and I'll tell you the reason, we were wondering, Kane Chemical was just doing so well, we started to think about going public. We've got studies of what it's worth if you go public. And the Nalco company has had for a long time a quail hunt every year, which they invite people from the chemical industry, and I have gone for a number of years. And I'm going this Thursday, and then on a comparable Thursday in '88, I went on it. And one of the people there was a man named Dale Lawrence of Occidental. And he told me Occidental wanted to buy this and offered $800 million for it. And I laughed at him, went away, and about 6 weeks later, they called back and offered us $1.2 million for the equity. And after a very short discussion, we made a deal and closed it 5 weeks later, which was transferred the money 5 weeks later, which was almost a record in this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We sold this company that we'd started, the equity that we put $27 million in, we sold it for $1.2 million, which in less than a year, which, you know, just can't be anything. But
in that short period of time, see how I can phrase this. You were able to acquire these companies because the big companies were getting out of commodities and looking for specialties.
They wanted to upgrade them.
Looking for a faster profit. So all of a sudden these became available, then the market turned around after you had acquired them. But what was it that Occidental saw that made them go to make an offer of that magnitude?
Since these are fairly bright people, I think they first were confident they could pay for it before the boom was over. Mm-hmm. Second, that, you know, it sort of fit in their whole overall scheme of things. And Occidental has never been like some of the other. It has been a commodity operation pretty much, you know, whether it's hog carcasses or oil, or even in the oil business, they haven't done much upgrading. And so it fit in the Occidental pattern, and they, as I say, were confident the boom would last long enough that they'd get their money back, and so they did. And so it worked very well. They're happy with the deal.
One of the things also that I've noticed is that you have, I don't know if you've insisted, but it's certainly you have involved employee ownership.
I have.
And for a number of reasons, one of which gives you a more dedicated employee and more efficiency in your operation. But I also read that when you sold Kane Chemical, you personally weren't convinced, but it was the welfare of your employees and their benefit from that sale.
I think that's essentially true, because see, at that point I had enough money that money was not much factor anymore. Here's something that I'd put together. I was running it differently from other people, the way other people run, and it was a great temptation to see if, you know, if this thing would really go forward. But here I had, sitting around the table with me, were these Bill McMahon, John Lutz, and all who essentially had most everything they had in this thing. And I just couldn't bring myself to put them at risk by insisting that they not cash in at this point. And so that, you know, I would love to have kept it, but it just didn't make any sense to me to keep them from cashing in.
I had a couple notes here. We've mentioned a few of these things, but I let's see if I can find the right page. A number of reasons why your LBOs were successful. We've talked about employee ownership. We've talked about not having upper level management that you had to bring along that gave you more flexibility, and you could cut off some of those layers. Supply contracts with major companies, so you didn't have to have a big sales force.
Yeah. Well, you know, DuPont, when we took over the polyethylene business, had a 30-man sales force. We had a 3-man sales force, because we just decided in the beginning that a lot of these small accounts are just, they're not worth fooling with. And we've done the same thing in Sterling Chemical. We have a lot of what you'd call processing agreements. That if Phillips, for example, wants styrene, we'll take their benzene and ethylene, and make and we're doing that to make styrene for Monsanto. Probably a third of our styrene business is on processing contracts, and this has several advantages. You don't need a lot of salesmen. But the other big one is you don't have any working capital tied up. And when in this sort of thing, you get very conscious of money and capital. And some of the things we've done consistently is we operate consistently at much lower inventories than any of our predecessors did, which means we use that money to pay off debt. We've consistently run with fewer rail cars than they use. One of the things that happened, and again, this is an accident. When we bought Vista, one of the first things that happened was that Ford Motor Company said, in order to sell to us, you have to have a statistical process control program. And I thought that's a lot of crap because we never had a quality problem. But if you had to do that, you had to do it. So we looked around and I discovered for the first time from Dr. Deming. I don't know if you've run across Deming at all or not. But, and we got one of his disciples to come in and give courses, and I got pretty sold on the whole thing. And as a result of that, we made major improvements in our operations. As I say, we're consistently using about 20 cent fewer tank, fewer rail cars than our predecessors used. We're running at much lower inventories than they did. We have operate with less working capital. I think we probably just across the board have a more effective operation, mainly because this is employee involvement. Because part of the Deming philosophy is that when you start trying to direct something, you don't invite the engineering department. You ask the people who are doing it how to do it better. And so we run very good operations.
Yes, I think I've read that what was it? You could reduce overhead by 70-80% sometimes.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. This isn't too accurate, but Monsanto was charging $27 million overhead to the Texas City plant, and it was all mixed up with other departments. When we took it over, we were running with $7 million over here. So that's the in Kane Chemical. We had a total overhead, including R&D, and we had a fair amount of R&D, of 2%. Now, a DuPont will have an overhead of 15%. Now, these are big numbers. Not only that, you run better. You have fewer levels of management. You have better communication. If everybody is busy, nobody has time to worry about protecting his turf and all that sort of thing. And one of the results of these team efforts to make improvements in the Deming system is that people start talking to each other across departments and across levels of management, and you get away from a lot of the things that you had before.
I imagine you get decisions made much more rapidly, and people feel more freer to make a decision without having to explain it to someone.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so, no, it's made a difference.
Was there life after Kane Chemical? I mean, that must have been a whirlwind years for you.
Well, the next thing is Celanese merged with Hoechst, and they were, as part of the deal, they had to divest their polyester fiber business, and they decided, or Hoechst was sort of calling the shots, and they decided to divest the Celanese business rather than the Hoechst business, and they put it out, and we bid on it, and were the successful bidder. And then we got into a long 6 months hassle with the FTC because they wanted they wanted Salonese to divest different things than Weekendine. Salonese wanted to divest, and not only that, they wanted to divest the wrong thing, even from their own, even from the FTC point of view, they were wrong. And we wouldn't have bought what the FTC wanted them to divest, because they wanted to divest the poorest plants. They didn't know that, but that's what they were, you know, what they were trying to do. So we went into a 6 month discussion, finally got them to approve it, put this together, ran it for a couple of years, did the same things here, and sold it to the Wellman Company after about 2 years. And the equity owners got in the 2 or 3 times what they put in, and the employees wound up with about twice their annual salary in the East Side.
Is there anything specifically that you can attribute your success in spotting these areas?
Well, I've never really thought about it as success, in any sense. I think a lot of it's luck. I think some of it is having been out of the business long enough to sort of get a detached view, because one of the surprising things is that so few people in the ethylene business recognize the turnaround, when if you look at the numbers, it's absolutely obvious. And I'm still baffled by why people in the business did not recognize it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just because if you stay close to something too long, you lose any sort of perspective. And I think, you know, getting out of it, I think, was helpful. The other thing, the Alaska experience was interesting for a different reason. I had, in the course of mergers and things like acquisitions and things, I'd run across a lot of investment bankers, but I never worked with them very closely. And so, at least one of the things I brought away from that was a confidence that money could be raised if you have a saleable idea. And I don't think that I had I'd ever appreciated that. And I suspect there are a lot of people with a good idea but are convinced they can't raise the money to do it, and you can if you know how.
Yeah. Let me ask the opposite question of the last one, and that is, have you had any failures?
I have. None of the ones that I have done have failed. My partners and I have some responsibility, but not a lot, have had a couple of failures. These have been relatively small. Mm-hmm. But none of the ones that I've done personally. And the deal I made when I set up the Sterling Group, that I would do these chemical things separately.
Okay.
And so Vista, Sterling Chemical, Kane Chemical, Fiber Industries, Arcadian, which is a fertilizer business, all the things I did separately.
Let me just review a little bit then about the Sterling Group, because I guess you and, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name.
Everdees.
Okay. Started it in...
I guess 82.
And then somewhere around 87, there was a merger with another investment.
We took another group in 87. We took a few individuals in. Then when Kane Chemical was sold, three of the partners made enough money, they just decided to retire.
Mm-hmm.
Retire. They're guys 40 or thereabouts. And then we had one woman partner who wanted to go into a different kind of business, and so when everybody was comfortably well off financially, so they did, and we have now four people left.
I see.
What is the climate of the 90s compared to the climate of the 80s?
Well, first, I think, at least in business I've been in, most of the things that people want to sell have been sold. Anybody who wanted to get rid of some odd kind of business has done it. Mm-hmm. Second, it is harder to raise money than it was back in the 80s. So I think the sort of thing I've done is going to slow down. There'll be fewer of them. You'll have to put more equity in them, which means that the leverage won't be as great. They won't be as profitable if they're successful, but you'll have a little more protection against failure. Where in Sterling Chemical, because of this BP contract, we put $5 million equity in a $215 million deal. Under 2.5% equity, and you know, if something like that's successful, the multiplier is just is tremendous. Now you won't do that anymore. Now you have to put 20 or 25% equity into things, and so there will not the big profit out of these things is gone, and the number of them is gone.
Well, you've essentially, I guess it's been, what, the last 10 years of your life where you've really been actively involved.
That's right, yes.
What do you see, what holds for you now at almost the age of 80?
I'll be 80 in 2 months or so.
Do you plan to continue your activities, or?
I don't know. You know, this may sound a little odd. I really haven't ever done much long-range planning. You know, at no point in my career have I done a lot of long-range planning, and I'm still not. I'm just going to do what interests me as long as it interests me. I'm not going to sit up till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning negotiating with lawyers anymore, and I'm not going to take one day. I made 3 trips to Spain. I made 2 trips to Spain and back in 1 week, in the Vista negotiation.
Right.
I'm not going to do that sort of thing. And right now, I came back from Florida this morning, and I'll go back Saturday and probably stay there a week or two. And
do you still have a place in Houston?
Or? Yes, we have a place here. And a place in North Carolina and one in Florida, so I'm not working all that hard.
We haven't talked about your family.
I was one of 6 children. I was the oldest. I have 2 brothers and 3 sisters, all still living. One brother's a doctor, still practicing. One is I was an editor of a textbook company, and he's retired. My sisters are married, and now as far as I didn't get married, I got married the first time when I was 44. We were married 12 years, didn't have any children. My wife died of cancer in 68. I remarried in 72. And Mary has had two children. They are, in their late 30s, early 40s. We have 3 grandchildren. I'm very fond of the grandchildren. Probably a typical grandchild. Do you have grandchildren?
No. In fact, I have a son who's only in junior high school. So I have, they're quite spread apart.
Yeah.
But no grandchildren yet. What let's see, how should I phrase this? What What did you do, or what do you do for fun? What do you enjoy besides mergers and acquisitions?
Okay. Well,
which obviously has given you a great deal of pleasure.
I play golf. I play croquet. I shoot in hunting. I do a lot of bird hunting in the hunting season, and that's how I got together with Occidental. I'm in the process. One reason I can be fairly articulate on this, I've been writing some of this.
Oh.
So I don't know whether it'll ever get published or not, but just for, if no other reason, for my grandchildren.
Sure.
And I'm putting much of this down. And I've finished Vista, Kane Chemical, and Sterling Chemical. That's the point at which I am now.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add at this point?
Not that I can think of.
It's been very fascinating, and I'd like to thank you for spending the time with me.
Well, thank you for taking the time to come. Who are you talking to anyone else around here?
Yes, would like to.
But you know. One of the things is, right now, we're having a crisis about jobs. And the evidence shows that the Fortune 100 companies had a decline in employment in the last 10 years of 2 million jobs. In the meantime, there's been a net production in jobs. And so all of the job production has been in the small and the medium-sized companies. Now, somehow, this problem is created not mainly by the fact that all these big companies let themselves get badly overstaffed, but also this decline in ownership management. I don't think we have yet found what both the Germans and the Japanese have found is the way to run big companies effectively. We now have a situation where the managements of big companies run the companies essentially without any guidance from the outside, because they choose their own directors. And I think it's significant that some of the big companies, even though what I say is true, there's still some outside influence. For example, DuPont is still very much influenced by the retired DuPont people, the DuPont family, and Dow is still dominated by a sort of Midland mystique, by the, if Carl is still around, I'm sure that he is still an influence. Now, that's true in a lot of companies, but you take General Motors as probably the worst example of the lot. Somehow, there's nobody at General Motors really thinking about the General Motors as an entity, and how do you make a long-range viable operation out of this? They've just gotten trapped in the bureaucracy they've built up. And here, 10 years ago, they dominated the automobile business, and here, 2 weeks or 2 months ago, the chairman of General Motors was going asking the Japanese not to be too tough on. If nothing else, is an embarrassment to the U.S. business world. Now, somehow we've got to find a way to bring some sort of direction in the specialists call it corporate governance into the running of large organizations. Well, this is Ralph and I. This is a field he and I both have been interested in, and I'm going to go out there.
Oh, yes, that's right. I did notice that you were involved with the Stanford program.
Yes.
He's spent quite a bit of time on
it. Yeah, he has. He's spent quite a bit of time. All right, and this is all involved in one of the factors that influence productivity and growth and things like that. So if I give out an interest in business, this sort of thing is where I'll go next. Because my golf game isn't good enough to make a career of that.
Well, okay, then. I'll thank you again.
Thank you.